from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about the need for foster care in Milwaukee and why keeping kids in their communities is so important. We'll hear the story of two brothers from Afghanistan now living in Milwaukee and how the legal battle over refugee resettlement could affect people like them.
From my own experience that I have as a refugee and the first generation in the United States, it would be impossible if you don't have any support from government.
Plus, we'll learn about a storefront that aims to reduce food waste and help farmers make the most of their produce year-round.
And I was just kind of shocked. I was like, this would just go to waste otherwise. Here I thought they'd have many places that they could sell or bring it to after the markets, but turns out a lot of the times it's compost.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee County is home to the largest number of foster children in Wisconsin, but it doesn't have enough foster homes to ensure children are kept in their communities. That's why children are sometimes placed far from their neighborhoods, schools, and support systems, which can add to the trauma of being removed from their families. One in three children entering foster care are placed more than 20 miles from their home. Advocates like Teresa Cocker say increasing the number of foster homes in Milwaukee could help keep children connected to their communities and reduce the long-term impacts of displacement. Cocker is the Chief Community Programs Officer at Norris, a local trauma-informed youth care facility. She tells WUWM's Eddie Morales about the current state of the foster care system.
What I would say is that there is a huge need for foster parents in the state of Wisconsin and specifically in Milwaukee County. Norris is a private organization and we receive referrals for children who need foster care placements from across the entire state. And out of all of the referrals we receive, about 70% come from Milwaukee. And that is about 70 kids per month that we are receiving referrals for kids needing placement.
How has that changed in recent years?
As a private organization that licenses level 3 therapeutic foster care parents, we have seen the trends maintain over the past several years. On average, we receive about 100 referrals a month for children needing placement, and that has remained steady. What we are seeing is that the needs of the kids that are being referred to our programs are increasing. So there are more kids who are experiencing mental health challenges, behavioral challenges, struggling with alcohol and drugs, and those are the kids who are needing placement.
You mentioned level 3. Can you describe some of the distinctions between those?
Sure. So in the state of Wisconsin, there is a level system for licensing foster parents, and most children are placed in levels 1 through 3. So that's what I can highlight for you. Level 1 licensing is child specific. So that would be a family friend or a relative who is interested in helping out a specific child. Level 2 foster care is general foster care, and counties across the state license level 2 foster parents. They don't necessarily have to have experience in parenting. They will receive some training and some support, and they will receive referrals for placement from those counties. Level 3 foster care is therapeutic or treatment foster care, and private agencies across the state license level 3 parents. So when we're looking for foster parents, we're looking for people who have experience either fostering, working in a helping field, maybe lived experience to build a foundation. And then we offer additional training and support because typically the children referred to our programs are presenting with higher needs.
What are the biggest challenges facing foster families, caseworkers, and children today?
I think the biggest challenges are finding resources to support stability for kids, whether that is in their foster homes or to be reunified with their families. There are challenges in finding therapists, in providing services, which could be mentoring for kids or crisis mentoring for kids. And it is a challenge because those resources aren't necessarily available.
You mentioned the importance of reuniting children with their families. What is the success rate of that locally, and how does that compare nationwide?
The primary goal, the majority of the time, is to reunify them with their birth families. We know that that's when kids succeed and do their best. In Wisconsin and across the nation, around 60-65% of children are reunified with their birth families.
What support is provided? You talked about some of the training and things like that. What support is provided to children, to foster parents? How is that evolving?
I can speak to the level three support that we provide at Norris. We hire master's level social workers to be our coordinators, and our coordinators are available 24/7 to our foster parents when they have placement in their home. We have weekly contact, at least every other week home visits, and then we provide training opportunities for our foster parents. The state has required training topics that they need to attend, but then we also offer additional training related to trauma and working with birth families.
And how can people help if people are interested in getting involved and sort of relieving some of the challenges that are being faced?
They can contact us at Norris. So our website is norriscenter.org. We also have a phone number, which is 262-222-2000. We also have an email, tfc@norriscenter.org. And we can talk about different ways to support. It could be applying to become a foster parent yourself. It could be applying to be a respite foster parent. So sometimes we license parents to help provide respite support to our long-term foster parents. So a foster parent could be caring for a child long-term, and then maybe they need some help on the weekends, or they need someone to help out at night. And we can have foster parents who maybe aren't able to commit to a long-term placement help out on a short-term basis. We also are always looking for people to help us recruit. So you might not be interested or able to foster, but you might know someone who is. So sharing our information on social media, being open to partner with us to host events and to share information. So really, there's a variety of ways people can help, and we're happy to meet people where they're at.
You offer a Milwaukee Rec class on foster care. Can you share some details about that?
Yes. So we offer a foster care in our community, which right now is primarily virtual. We offer two offerings a month. Those are available on our website. If you visit norriscenter.org, we have an events page and people are able to sign up there.
And what is some of the content of that class and what can people expect from it?
So people can learn the basics of the Child Protective Services system. So we review how children enter the system, what the goal of the system is, which is to reunify children with their birth families. We talk about different ways to help, and we talk about if someone is interested in applying to become a foster parent, we talk about the process. So how to apply, what we look for in foster parents, what the training is like, and what they can expect.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would just like to thank you for the opportunity, and that we are happy to talk with anyone who is interested in partnering with us, either to share the need for foster parents or to learn about how they can help.
Teresa Cocker is the Chief Community Programs Officer at Norris, a local trauma-informed youth care facility. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales about the state of foster care. Last week, a judge ordered that refugee resettlement continue in the U.S. On Inauguration Day, the Trump administration froze federal funding for refugee resettlement. And despite that court order, resettlement advocacy organizations say things have not resumed. Hanan Refugees Relief Group is one of the agencies that helps newly arrived refugees here in Milwaukee. Refugees like brothers Qadir and Bahadur Hotek, who came to Milwaukee a few years ago after the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. With help from Hanan, its executive director, Sheila Badwan, and others, they were able to make a home here. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez shares their story.
From 2001 till 2021, Afghan people experienced freedom, education, peace, and I can say in a very high level, although we had wars, but most likely the central cities were good and very peaceful and secure. We had a German Shepherd dog, and me and Khaled, we grew up together as play buddies, I would say, if this is the right word. We were playing together. We used to play football in the back of the house with the neighbor kids. And one time we visited our uncle's house in another province for not a very long trip, but like 15 days. And after we came back, all of our friends, they changed the football game. They changed it to cricket. We didn't know how to play it. I'd say we would force them to let us play twice. In cricket, when they take you out, you're done. But since we had our dog, we could force them to let us play it.
We really miss those days because life here in back home country is completely different. There is people more socialized because they play outside and all came together at the same places. Here too, but it's different because we are new here. We don't know like how things working. And our dog that Bahadur mentioned, we really missed him. And his name was Rambo. And we was choose that name from one of the John Rambo movies.
All right.
You grew up in Milwaukee.
I grew up in Milwaukee, yeah.
It seems it's like the same comparable example if you live right now in Milwaukee and have to go to Kabul.
Yeah, it would be, I don't think I would know what to do.
You can put it that way.
Yeah, I would feel very lost. So you have these wonderful memories and things seemed free. Of course, there were wars and there was fighting. And then things change very quickly.
On this Monday night, fear and desperation in Afghanistan.
Panic, chaos, a staggering collapse. The Taliban have taken Afghanistan.
Each province, based on their security and insecurity, kind of collapsed. And the war line was coming closer to the central, Kabul. In the meantime, things were normal in capital and president and different high-level government officials were just guaranteeing everything would be fine. August 15, so this is morning around 8:30 or 9, and Nangarhar city collapsed, and we saw the pictures, Facebook post, and they're saying they got the city. So it was like, we are surrounded in Kabul.
It was around 1 o'clock that the news said a president left the country. That was the worst news. And that time, I went out and see the screaming and saw people was in shock.
We were hiding and we were looking for opportunity to go to the airport. The airport was surrounded by concrete walls. And there were gates secured by U.S. troops. And only those gates were your way entry to heaven from hell. Thanks God. And the last attempt, we were able to get in.
When we was able to get into the airport, I still could remember, everybody was start crying. So we was able to fly on the same day. We sit in the airplane, there was a logistic one. It was like almost 600 people in the same airplane. We was don't know where they're going to get us. When we was in the camp, we was had HP numbers, which is called like each different case. They was putting the list, and if there was your HP number, it means you can get ready for your trip, and you're going to go resettle in one of the cities. So I did check the list on the morning, and it was really surprising because I did see my HP number on it. And then the next day, February of 2022, I left camp. We went to New Jersey. There was a city called Newark. Once I moved in, I had only $5 with me that I took from my brother. That's how I was started with those $5. And it's really a big thing, like story of my life, I can tell someone. We was walking in the street. We was see a sign. It was said, heroes working here. And there was no other sign to see, like, what is this place?
Yeah, we discussed, like, 3 or 4 minutes, should we ring the place or not?
I was the one that speak English, and I had no confidence on myself because, like, I was new and I was, like, really scared. So we was discussed, like, should we go ring or maybe knock on the door to see, like, if they hire people or no? So we did knock on the door. There was a woman. She said, like, how can I help you guys? We just said, we just saw the sign. Are you guys need worker? She said, come upstairs. She was open the door for us. And there was a really nice office. There was, like, the boss. We talked to him, and we told him, like, we just moved here, and we're looking for a job. He said, like, okay, yeah, we will give you a job. And we all was, like, so happy, and, like, we couldn't imagine at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he told us that you guys could start from tomorrow, $14 per hour. And the father was said, like, no, it's 13. And we said, like, don't worry about the dollar. But today we know, like, a dollar, how much it's going to be a difference in our wages. So we said, like, don't worry about it. So it's okay.
So what was the job?
Bakery.
Yeah, I did start with packing breads. And every night we was packing, like, 2,500 breads.
Finally, we decided we want to join Raza, my oldest brother, who was in Milwaukee. And he was the primary client for Hanan Refugee Relief Group. We were six family members, four adults, two kids, in a two-bedroom apartment, which is kind of very tight for a two-bedroom apartment for six people. And not the very right day, but, like, we had a week until we met Sheila. And she just opened the drawer and gave us a key. It was just the front apartment to my brother's house. She said, it's prepaid. You guys can live. It's paid for a few months' rent, security deposit, and the case manager would help you guys with the household items. It was generous.
We were still starting our life because we was just here, like, for 6 months. So all we do have today is all because of Sheila, sister, and also Hanan Refugee Relief Group. We are really grateful for that.
We moved from New Jersey to Milwaukee. We would be like, we moved from the city to the village. I don't know if he's still on that belief or not, but I think I'm not.
Yeah, once we moved to Milwaukee and we left New York City because we was left very close to downtown, it was like American dream. Tall buildings, busy city. You got to see all those different sport cars. From my own experience that I have as a refugee and the first generation in the United States, it would be impossible if you don't have any support from government. Because all the refugees are moving to United States, they came with nothing. Because they are looking for better life opportunities and to start new life. New life, it means you don't have anything, you don't know how to start. So there should be someone take your hand and at least guide you till you can afford everything by yourself. As we see most recently, some changes in the administration about all those funds in freeze, it's a negative effect on millions of individual human lives. Yes. What do you think, Bahadur, about these recent changes about funding for refugees and new arrivals?
I basically have kind of the same view. Well, I can put myself in a position, and we came in. We don't had no immediate family or relatives here. And if we don't had the agency to help us, God knows. I don't think we would have a chance talking with you right now here today.
Once I moved here in Milwaukee, I really find all these people very kind. And they was very acceptable and very welcoming. They were the one that show us how to live and how to start our life and make everything organized. But, like, today I feel Milwaukee as my home. What do you think, Bahadur, about this experience?
Yeah, I think while we lived in New Jersey, we were more like a guest over there. And maybe if we stayed till right now, maybe kind of different experience right now. But at the time while we were there, basically, we didn't start our life like as we did here. because we had more opportunities, more people around us. The English language that I learned is because of one of the volunteers of Hanan. We received this help and we have to repay it back one way or the other. And I think that's the kind of feeling that everybody must have. We were a time of need and people gave us a hand.
Those were brothers Bahader and Kader Hotek. They resettled in Milwaukee from Afghanistan in 2023 with help from Hanan Refugees Relief Group. It's one of the agencies affected by a recent suspension in federal funding for refugee resettlement. They spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up in about 10 minutes, Bubbler Talk explores those "We Buy Houses" sign you see around Milwaukee. But first, we'll speak with a business owner whose goal is to keep local food as affordable and accessible as possible.
What really motivated a lot of it, too, was going from the country, growing up on a farm, and then moving to the city, and noticing the biggest difference between country poor and city poor was the food. Period.
That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Over 1 billion pounds of food waste and scraps is discarded annually, making it the largest contributor to our landfills, according to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. However, despite the alarming amount of food waste, 1 in 7 households face food insecurity. Alina Joling wants to not only decrease food waste, but help support farmers in the off-season with her storefront, Farmers Market To Go. By working with local growers, the store offers them a place to sell the goods they still have outside of farmers markets and gives consumers a place to access fresh, local food all year round. Joling's store was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins me now to share more, starting with Farmers Market To Go's unique business model.
Technically, I'm the owner, but all the vendors own their own shelves. They keep 100% of their profits. So it is organized more like a cooperative without some of the legal challenges that cooperatives face. Essentially, we wanted to give space year-round to growers, farmers, and producers that are local. They have a tough time getting into bigger grocery stores, and so farmers market season is really where they make a majority of their income. And that can mean very hard winter months, of course. So a lot of farmers even have greenhouses that they don't use. And we would like to see more of those used during those winter months if they had just a place to sell it. So the way it's organized is that vendors can buy their own shelf. They share the monthly expenses. They keep all their profits. We don't add anything to the price. We don't take anything from, you know, their ultimate outcome because their profit margins are pretty small, especially when you're working on a smaller scale. And then for us, on the consumer side, which I am, it's so that we can eat this really good food all year round instead of just during the farmers market season.
Yeah, and you are also a business owner outside of establishing Farmers Market To Go. So what kind of lessons did you learn from your other entrepreneurship journeys that influenced a different model that you'd like to employ to allow your farmers to keep, you know, their profits?
Sure. So Melita was my first business, and it was a knife sharpening business that I started because I wanted to see a higher quality sharpening out there. And we really focus a lot on education so that customers know, you know, no matter where they're going to get their stuff sharpened, what to look for, what to look out for. But we really made a majority of our income at farmers markets. And just like all other vendors, you know, we had that plummet in the winter. So we started a kitchen store that's Better Knife and Kitchen Store. And that's now, you know, sort of an extension. It gives people more of a reason to come out during those winter months rather than making a special trip just for sharpening. And, you know, I think a lot of times when we're facing a problem, we can think it's just our own problem, when really it's probably something everybody struggles with. And the more that I talk to these folks that I've been doing markets with for, this is going to be my 15th season, so we've been working together for a long time, I'd find out that they had that same exact issue, where it was really tough to maintain the staff that you need during the summer season, during those winter months. Also, kind of like, I didn't realize how much local food was being wasted until my farmers market friends, they would find out that I was a farm kid, and suddenly I'd be getting gifted these obscene amounts of produce. Yeah. And, you know, I would say, you know, Tom, I really don't need a lot of carrots, just a few, and I'd turn around and he's running away from my table, leaving a gigantic box. And I kind of started to question them about, you know, like, why are you doing this to me? Because they knew they are giving me work, you know. They're not just giving me, it seems like it is a beautiful gift, don't get me wrong. Local stuff, local produce is some of the best we got. But they knew I would be up until 3 a.m. canning or, you know, preserving it in some sort of way. And they really told me, like, well, we're giving it to you because we know you're a farm kid. We know you won't waste it. Mm. And I was just kind of shocked. I was like, this would just go to waste otherwise. Here I thought, like, you know, they'd have many places that they could sell or bring it to after the markets. But turns out a lot of the times it's compost. So that really, and that was probably a decade ago, that I really started going, man, we really need a place to sell this stuff all year round. And even after the markets during the week in the summer, that they can drop stuff off and have a further chance. And then all the people, too, who don't necessarily have time, or maybe they're working during the hours, the 4 hours that the market is once a week, that they can't make it to those markets. And I think a lot of people, even in the restaurant industry in particular, I think of, they love to cook. They want to eat, you know, the higher quality food, too, but not being able to make it to those markets because of those later hours.
Right. Now, with the relationships you've established being at farmers markets for the past 15 years, you have used that pool of people to also help support your business. So tell me about your team and, you know, what roles Jenny Lee and Angela Mo play.
Yeah, so I've known both of them for quite some time. Angela has been one of my biggest, like, supporters and fans, actually, since I started my sharpening business. We did the Shorewood Farmers Market together since its inception, really. And she had this same sort of concept. She had tried, you know, several times to help other people get it going, but they always saw it fail. When she told me that, I was like, give me all the advice. Give me everything you learned from those experiences, because we're certainly not immune to that. So my, you know, sort of the different thing that we're doing is that, you know, we're not adding anything to the price. We're not taking anything. And I think that's important to run a space like this and not do it to make a profit, because it makes it unaffordable for the customers who want to shop there. It makes it really, I guess, just too expensive for anybody, you know, because the farmers and producers, if they're not selling as much, they're really not going to be able to sustain keeping their products there either. So she was a great help in just, like, giving ideas and being a good sounding board when we wanted to try this or that when we were first starting. And Jenny Lee has this huge presence in the Milwaukee food scene. And there is actually a space, and so this is really exciting, too, that we have this, like, additional new thing coming, is that in this space, it used to be a bar and a restaurant. We split it up into threes, so now it's like a salt and sauna place, get your wellness on. You know, we have the kitchen store with Molita sharpening, and then farmers market to go, of course. There's actually still, and we're developing it in the next couple of months, is a commercial kitchen, to have a new rentable commercial kitchen, because these are really, really needed. And that's been a huge thing I've learned in talking to all the vendors, too. I really went into this not knowing anything about the food industry, about licensing. You know, a huge thank you to the county health department for really, I talked to them early, as well as the Department of Agriculture. They were fantastic at, like, meeting with me, talking me through, answering really any little question that I had. But one of the things and the biggest obstacles, and I've seen it over and over and over again now, is not having access to a commercial kitchen. Because in order to sell anything retail, you can't do the home baker license or the pickle bill. You have to have that commercial kitchen to work out of. And a lot of them are, they're huge, they're beautiful, but they're not really set up for very small makers or people who only need necessarily a portion of a kitchen. So I think we have an opportunity to do something different there as well, where it's broken up into sections that people can rent. And I think it's going to enable a lot of people who started their small business, you know, they're entrepreneurs, but they're having a hard time making it out of that farmer's market, like just doing anything beyond that, I think it's really going to help. That's where Jenny Lee comes in. She's got all the commercial kitchen experience. I've got all the build-out experience. We're sort of joining forces to make this happen. And I think that's when we're going to see farmer's market go really take off, too, with a lot more, because we do have convenience food. You know, we have food for the busy folks, too. It's just endless, the combinations and meals. I think it's a lot bigger than most people expect when they hear about it. And then they come in and they go, whoa. And we're like, yeah, we've got like 50 vendors at this point. We've got 100 shelves that are full of delicious local food.
You mentioned you're a farm girl and grew up here in Wisconsin on a farm. Do you credit that for your community mindset to have a model where you're consciously saying, like, no, it's about staying operational and supporting other people?
I do think that is some to credit, because when you grow up with that close of a relationship to your food, you really see all the work that goes into it. I think there's a lot of people who fantasize about that lifestyle that don't know what it really takes. I mean, just to say, like, yeah, I could go without vacations because, you know, animals can't not be fed. So unless you're like a wealthy farmer who can afford farmhands or that type of thing, it is a pretty sustenance lifestyle. And I think what really motivated a lot of it, too, was going from the country, growing up on a farm, and then moving to the city and noticing the biggest difference between country poor and city poor was the food, period. Like, I might have had, you know, a similar, like, we weren't one of those wealthy farmers, we'll say that. But I got to eat like a queen. I realized I was probably eating better than a lot of wealthy people in bigger cities, even, because I was eating it fresh out of the garden. I was eating it, you know, like pretty freshly butchered meat. All of that, and even the way that we treated the animals, everything about it was just on a higher level. So I was like, wow, those are the really two biggest differences. And then I've been really inspired, too, by, like, you know, the work of Miss Venus Williams. I've done markets with her for a very long time, too. And I'm going, yes, because that is the biggest difference between, you know, poverty in these two places is a closer connection with the food and having access to more fresh, locally grown and produced food.
Well, Alina, I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing to try and make this gap a little smaller and to share where food comes from with the greater public.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time today, Audrey.
Alina Joling is the owner of Farmers Market To Go in Brookfield. It was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM reporter Catherine Kokel. Drive around Milwaukee and it's not hard to find one. They're small, often handwritten signs stuck into the grass or tied onto light poles. They promise, we'll buy your house. There's usually a phone number, sometimes a reminder that the unnamed creator of the sign will take your house in any condition. Kathy Hoffman lives in Glendale, and she says she sees the signs around the city all the time. She also gets incessant mailers with offers to buy her home, even though she's not selling.
I guess I'm really curious about who's buying these houses and what happens to them. What are they doing with them?
To answer that question, I turn to Mike Rizicka, president of the Milwaukee Area Realtors Association. He says, even though these signs can look like hastily made craft projects, they're not necessarily scams.
Basically, it's a type of flipping, which is a completely valid business model. And so these organizations are coming in and purchasing a property under what the price would be if you listed it, for example, to sale on the open market. And they take the property, they fix it up, and then they resell it.
Sometimes the houses are flipped and converted into rental properties or multifamily housing. The key part that makes the business work is paying below the home's market value. That's according to one owner of a Milwaukee area flipping company who answered my questions about the process but didn't agree to go on the record because she says she has several deals in the works right now. Here's how it works. Before a flipper buys a property, their assessors walk through the house, tally up all the work it needs, and then deduct the cost of those repairs from the offer presented to the seller. The company also factors in how much it hopes to profit from the sale. For example, a home valued at $250,000 could be sold to a flipper for $200,000. The sale would go through quickly without the seller making any repairs, and then the flipper would gut the home, do the repairs, and list the home for, say, $300,000. That math usually works better if the home is in need of lots of work, or if the seller is eager to be done with it. Rizika says that serves a purpose in the real estate industry writ large.
The example I always use is if the parents have died and two children are out of the state, in different parts of the country, and they just don't have time to deal with the property, they just want to get rid of it as quickly as possible, the seller and the people that are listing the property really have to understand they're doing it at a significant discount because the flipping company wants to make a profit. But it does, it definitely serves a niche.
Flipping companies often work faster than working with a real estate agent. But flipping can stress a housing market that's already pricing people out. Since the pandemic, Milwaukee has seen a spike in out-of-state investors buying properties, leaving fewer affordable options for aspiring home buyers. Chad Venn is a professor and the director of UW-Milwaukee's real estate program at the Lubar School of Business. He was thrust into this particular area of the industry last year after his grandmother passed away.
We were contacted by a number of different cash buyers from the moment she passed, and they were offering us a quick close, no inspections, no contingencies. But that was a house that had been in our family's history for about 70 years.
Home flippers can use public records to target their advertising to families that may have paid off homes or people who may need cash quickly, like someone moving into a nursing home or someone who has just gotten a divorce. People who sell may solve a short-term problem by getting the cash, but can create long-term problems by selling their family's largest asset below market value. Ben's family ultimately decided to sell his grandmother's house, but not to one of the cash for homes flippers. They sold to a nonprofit called Acts Housing, which flips homes but guarantees the home will be sold to a family instead of used as an investment property.
They work with a lot of people who might not have access to traditional lending routes. Maybe they have low credit score, maybe they have no credit score, maybe they have some blemishes on their record. And the Axe Housing team works with them to try to get them in a position where they can buy it and become a homeowner.
After generations in his family, Venn says he hopes his grandmother's house can now become an anchor for someone new.
What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one more break, and then we'll learn about the history of drag in Milwaukee. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Last month, the historic LGBTQ bar This Is It closed suddenly. The bar opened in 1968, making it Wisconsin's longest-running gay bar. And during that time, the bar hosted a myriad of events, including drag shows. Michael Takash and BJ Daniels are the authors of A History of Milwaukee Drag. It explores the roots and evolution of drag in Milwaukee and how present-day attacks on drag performers echo what we've seen in the past. Takash and Daniels join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the book and drag history.
In reading this book, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn just how early on in Milwaukee's history that we start to see drag performances. What was that like back in the, you know, late 1800s?
So the art of drag, as we know it, you know, as an art form, really began in the United States around the end of the Civil War. And there were a number of traveling minstrel shows that went around the country raising money for Civil War widows. And one of those companies was Francis and Kelly. And Francis Leon, who is known now to be the first drag performer in Wisconsin history, came to Milwaukee on June 7th, 1884, and performed a really groundbreaking show at Neunemacher's Opera Hall. And at this point, he was really at the height, if not a bit of a decline in his career. He and his partner, romantic and business, had traveled the world, had gone to Australia, to Europe, to Asia, performing these numbers in which Leon, in female attire, portrayed this prima donna, this woman who was being wooed by several men. And the audience was in on the joke that this was not a woman, but an actual man dressed as a woman for their entertainment. In fact, the Milwaukee audience reviewed the show after that June 7th performance and said that Francis Leon could make a fool of a man if it didn't know that he was a man. And most people in the audience don't believe that Francis Leon is male at all. So it was really fascinating to read this and understand like kind of what the mindset and the mood of the times were, which were, you know, that this emerging art form separate from the minstrel shows and evolving into something really dramatically different was happening at a time when, you know, Milwaukee didn't have paved streets. It didn't have electricity. Most homes didn't have indoor plumbing. But they had drag shows, and they were seen as a sign that Milwaukee was maturing and becoming more sophisticated and really not just this roughneck pioneer town anymore, but that we had arts and culture.
One of the running themes through this book is kind of the dichotomy with which we perceive drag on stage, and then how we view female male impersonation, as it was called, outside of that context. One of the things that really struck me was the story of Julian Elting and Ralph Kerwinio being investigated as a male impersonator, maybe even more stark at the height of the McCarthy era, homosexual panic. We have a person like Adrian Ames, a drag queen, a leader of nightlife in Milwaukee. How do we square those disparities throughout this timeline?
Well, I think that what you look at is like what was considered entertainment, but that entertainment could not translate to real life. The thing is, these people were all okay as long as they were at a distance. When that was bridged and you came into, you left that stage in that other dimension, you kind of crossed that fourth wall, that was where the panic came in. Because then now suddenly it's something else. Now it's insidious, it's perverse, it's sinful, it's criminal. So that has been the dichotomy forever. You're okay as long as you stay in your place. The minute you cross out of that and try to, you know, mingle with the general public, you're a criminal.
Yeah. And that's a really distinct boundary. All of the people that you've mentioned were entertainers, and they were entertainment for straight people. They were not, you know, welcoming to gender nonconforming people. They were not welcoming to sexually diverse people. These were shows that were really intended for like upper crust, refined audiences. Whether it was in the 1880s or all the way up until the 1950s, when, you know, there was this drag craze in Milwaukee that it was on the level of RuPaul's drag craze today. You know, there were over 20 venues that had nightly drag shows, and none of them were gay bars. And that's the interesting distinction, I think, that we look at historically, is that up until recently, up until maybe the 1970s, drag was not seen as a representation of the LGBT community. It was not seen as, you know, a reflection of one's own true identity. It was seen as kind of like a carnival.
It was kind of like a novelty act.
Well, and that seems to be one of the big things that characterizes this pretty large time period, honestly, from the 1880s down through at least the 1950s, the kind of criminalization of being queer, being a female impersonator, a male impersonator, being in any way genderqueer. What did that look like during that time period?
That's something that people don't understand today. And that, I think, was one of the biggest findings of the book, was that drag was not part of gay life until the late 1960s. It was not something that was allowed in gay bars. Drag performers or people who were challenging gender norms, or, you know, dressing, cross-dressing as it was once known, were simply too risky to have in your property. They would attract attention. Many patrons believed that they were spies for the police. They were presumed to be sex workers rather unfairly. So today we think of, and you hear this rhetoric around, you know, drag performers inducing children into this deviant lifestyle. But I mean, for most of its history as an art form, drag was not something associated with gay people at all.
It's interesting looking at the book. You have this time period called the Golden Age of Drag. I think it was 1981 to 1991, something like that. And when I think of that time period in LGBTQ history, I, of course, think of this deadly pandemic that was killing so very many young men. What made that moment a golden time for drag, despite the other things that were happening?
The shocking discrimination, the fear-mongering, all of a sudden, your presence on stage was needed to shore up the troops, if you will. People went out to clubs throughout the 80s as a measure of support. And so in a strange way, the LGBT community really came together and queens led the way because they were there. They were the ones that were on stage. They were the ones that were out in front.
And another point is that, you know, even before AIDS arrived, we think now in retrospect that the 80s was a decade that was, you know, completely tainted by AIDS. And it was in the later half of the decade, mm-hmm. at least in Wisconsin. But the first half of the decade was very different than we remember it. I mean, we were coming out of the disco era. There was this great sense of liberation and accomplishment and momentum and movement for gay rights. And there was this great sense of access and integration due to the disco movement. Discos were places that, like, everyone came together from across, you know, racial and sexual and, you know, economic backgrounds. And nowhere demonstrated that better than the gay bars of the era, like Circus or the Red Baron or Park Avenue. So looking at the success of those venues, they were, again, very pioneering investors who created these new spaces and really ramped things up.
It feels like right now we're in a different kind of golden age of drag as a result of RuPaul's Drag Race. Your last chapter, of course, deals with this a lot. We have two winners from Milwaukee, Trixie Mattel and Jada Essence Hall. We have another queen from Milwaukee who is just on the current season of Drag Race, James Mansfield. How has that Drag Race, how has that changed the drag world we see now in Milwaukee?
Well, I think it's like we're going back to the 50s again. I remember when RuPaul's Drag Race first started on TV, and it was very, like, niche, you know, like, it was just you were sharing this with a few of your friends. You're like, oh, my God, did you see that show? It's called Drag Race. And it's, and then all of a sudden it was like, you know, their sister started watching it with them, then their mom, you know, and all of a sudden, I think, honestly, the show became a phenomenon because it was so accessible to, like, the general public. There was a fallow period there that then got this dramatic uplift in the 2000s because of the show. And from there, you know, sprang all these other stories of people who said, wow, you know, now there's something more to aspire to than just a local title, you know, a local booking. Drag queens started looking at things differently. And the fact that so many people came from Milwaukee and from the Milwaukee drag scene that have been able to achieve all this success, I think, especially Jada and Trixie, they're both two sides of a different coin. Jada is just this really talented makeup artist, designer, hilarious, you know, all these things. Trixie is a writer, a musician, a comedian. I'm not surprised. I think Milwaukee's always had a really big creative community. And I think RuPaul's Drag Race kind of pushed it forward. And then, of course, two Hamburger Marys opening here. It was a cool thing to go see drag shows again. So all of a sudden, I think it really, all those things converged in one.
And I think that they all converged on a foundation that people didn't even know they had. And I think that is probably one of the most startling things about my work and our work as a history project. There's this whole extensive history out there and heritage that so few people know about and so few people even realize influenced them in so many ways. The structures and the connections and the traditions and the rituals that, you know, were founded over this long series of seven generations is what bred these modern day RuPaul superstars. I mean, they came up in an environment that was had all of these influences and all of this precedent, and they benefited from it and flourished. And I think that that's amazing. I mean, I think back to, you know, the 50s and the 30s and the even the 1910s and what those people would think if they knew that 100 years later, there were international superstars coming out of Milwaukee doing drag. I think it would just blow their minds.
BJ, Michael, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks
for having us.
Michael Takash and BJ Daniels are the co-authors of A History of Milwaukee Drag, Seven Generations of Glamour. Takash is a curator for the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, and Daniels is a legendary Milwaukee drag queen. They both joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2023. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Catherine Kokel, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Eddie Morales from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reevy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn about how local businesses can contract with the city of Milwaukee and learn about Wisconsin Idols, a new book about heroic figures with unique ties to the Badger State. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.